But of course, this is also where Frontex plays a big role. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What exactly is Frontex doing in the Mediterranean?
Yes, so there are several operations in various points in the Mediterranean. So the operation that you're referring to is called Operation Poseidon, through which there are some Frontex or like vessels that are coordinated, so ships that are coordinated by Frontex that would, for example, have a Danish or Romanian crew on board, but they're part of a Frontex joint operation. There's also Frontex surveillance, so an aircraft would be in the airspace above Greek territorial waters to monitor the situation. There's also various operations, for example, Operation Indalo in the Mediterranean between Morocco and Spain, Operation Sophia and or Irini, kind of in the central Mediterranean. So there's various points at which Frontex is supporting EU member states, either with a surveillance presence or with presence through ships in the water, though increasingly that is surveillance and not ships. And that in itself is a problem for search and rescue availability, and also where the information from surveillance ends up going. In the Aegean Sea, so Operation Poseidon, the allegations that we've had recently are of Frontex compliance with or knowledge of illegal pushbacks by the Greek Border and Coast Guard. So either that Frontex was complicit in illegal pushbacks, which are currently being investigated by multiple organisations, including Frontex itself, though this is an internal investigation which is unlikely to yield much, but
but they are, you say they are maybe complicit in these pushbacks, but are they also actively engaged in pushbacks somewhere, or not that you know of? I mean, as Frontex
No, almost always it will be a member state and Frontex will be present to support them, but the coordinating or the kind of the officer in charge will be a national officer, so that's all directed from a member state's coordination centre. However, I think like that kind of does hide the situation a little bit. For example, in the Mediterranean, sorry, I'm kind of getting all the operation names confused. But like, so outside of joint operations, Frontex is involved with the training of the so-called Libyan Coast Guard. That's been going on since 2016. So that is in theory or in their marketing materials, that is described as training the Libyan Coast Guard, as it's called, to prevent migrant smuggling, but ignores the fact that the Libyan Coast Guard is actually made up of individuals who have been shown to be smugglers and traffickers themselves. And then also their surveillance in that area, like through the Eurosur, the European Surveillance at External Borders. Often that information will also inform the Libyan Coast Guard before a European Coast Guard of boats in distress. So many people will end up being pulled back rather than pushed back to situations of detention, torture and inhuman and degrading treatment and punishment. So in terms of its like joint operations, it's there. I haven't seen any evidence of Frontex being the kind of the driver of a pushback rather than like someone who might have been there. But I mean also there's so much about problems with its serious incident reporting system, where officers have tried to report things going wrong, and there are allegations that that hasn't has been discouraged. So I think there is no proof of that happening, and I would not want to say it on the radio that Frontex has been like the driver of it. But also, you know, there's a wider question of kind of the culture within Frontex discouraging this this accountability, this transparency, and also discouraging individuals who probably don't want to be complicit in a horrible situation or an action that will return someone to an awful situation, but being made to feel that they can't say anything about it and they can't whistleblow.
Yes. And is Frontex one of the main topics that you as State Watch are researching? And if so, in what way do you research them? What kind of things do we need to think about then?
Oh, yes. So one of our kind of primary research priorities is migration and asylum and how the EU approaches that or tries to avoid approaching that. And I spend a lot of time researching Frontex as part of that research priority. And we have a project that was funded by the Open Society Initiative for Europe. And that project looks at three agencies, Frontex, Europol, and the EU IT interoperable system, EULISA. And I mainly look at Frontex. And the main things we're looking at there are the first of three reports we published was about Frontex's role in deportations from the European Union and how that has grown since 2004, especially in the last five or so years. We're also now looking into Frontex's use of personal data, and that's in terms of the databases that officers would have access to, especially now that many of those databases are being interconnected, and the possible dangers that might entail, but also bearing in mind that Frontex are present and often the first person someone will see when arriving at an EU migration hotspot. So for example, in Lesbos or in Lampedusa, many people will often speak to a Frontex officer before a doctor. So it's also the information that Frontex gathers immediately from people who are arriving and in distress. And then we are also looking, and I think this is how you got in touch with me, I'm working with Mariana Cliatti on a report on Frontex's role in the externalization of the EU's border policy.
Ah, okay. Yeah. I understand.
So yes. That's the link. That's where we're... Yeah, and Mariana actually also co-wrote the report on deportations with us.
Okay, very interesting. I don't know if Bart wants to ask something, but maybe one last question from my side is, because this is something that we always ask people, what can our listeners do, apart from giving donations, of course, to State Watch, but is there anything that our listeners can do to prevent Frontex from doing their bad or showing their bad behavior?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. I think I think it's probably really useful for all listeners to know that all EU citizens or residents in the EU have the right to request access for documents. So if there are issues with transparency, they can exercise that right, and either by reaching out to me at State Watch, I can talk anyone through that process. So my email is jane@statewatch.org, or there is a form on the Frontex website. So that's one way if there are certain elements of confusion or documents that people feel would increase transparency. And then I think also, I suppose there's currently a LIBE committee, so that's the European Parliament Civil Liberties Committee inquiry or a scrutiny group into the recent allegations. So I suppose, I don't know, support of that in some way, either, I guess, through like electing MEPs who support it whenever that comes around next. Mm-hmm. That's useful because there are, like, you know, there are very different takes on this situation in the parliament, with certain groups such as the European People's Party kind of almost always backing anything Frontex does, and other groups really trying to push the fundamental rights aspect of oversight and the need for accountability. But But the issue of transparency has come up a lot, all the groups want to exercise their mandate and actually get the documents they request from Frontex. So in terms of transparency, I suppose that those are the things to look at. How else? I don't really know how else one supports this. the drive.
Okay.
I suppose I'm just engaging with MEPs about the fact that there's a really unaccountable body.
Ja, ik ben er nog. I'm there.
Platypus serieus, het eindigt met een end.
Yes. Hey, thank you very much, James, for all this information.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I'll send you a mail tomorrow. Okay. Thank you very much.
Context. Wat kunnen we daar aan doen? Daar waren we een beetje bij gebleven.
Yeah. How else? I don't really know how else one supports this. the drive.
Okay.
I suppose I'm just engaging with MEPs about the fact that there's a really unaccountable body acting in.
Hello.
Ja, ik ben er nog. I'm there.
Platypus serieus, het eindigt met een end.
Yes. Hey, thank you very much, James, for all this information.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I'll send you a mail tomorrow. Okay. Thank you very much.
Brilliant.
Wat
Thank
kunnen we daar doen? Daar waren we een beetje bij gebleven. Dus er is wel geluid hier nog, hè? Of denk ik dat maar? Ja. Oh. Ik ben eruit. Nu Scholten bellen. Laten we Scholten bellen. Oh, als hij opneemt. Dat zal wel mooi zijn. Dan past het allemaal in elkaar, zullen we maar zeggen. Met de R, hè, van Rob, hè, denk ik. Ja, oké. Ja, ik heb. Ja, hey, Rob Scholten, Bart hier van Patapoes Serieus. Het gaat toch op de hele primitieve manier. Er stond een stukje in de krant en er kwam op neer. Er is een rechtszaak geweest over een veiling. Een veilinghuis wil die in beslag genomen boedel gaan veilen. In totaal moet het 3,5 ton opbrengen, maar daar zit bruikleenwerk tussen, wat je eigenlijk helemaal niet kan veilen. Maar goed, dan zijn er weer niet de bruikleenovereenkomsten van. Tenminste, dat was een stukje in NRC Handelsblad. Hoe zit dat ongeveer in elkaar? Kan je daar iets over zeggen?
Ja, dat kan ik zeker. Nee, het is niet allemaal wat je denkt of wat je leest in de krant is waar. Er is nooit een ruggespraak gehouden hierover. En ik heb daar heel weinig bruikleen gehad. Er staan een paar in. En die moeten er ook uit. Alleen, zoals ik al 3 jaar lang niet heb kunnen kijken wat er in beslag genomen is, alles is meegenomen. Dus het is niet alleen het museum geweest, maar ook alle inhoud van mijn studio. Alle souvenirs, alle kindertekeningen, alles waar ze gewoon niet van wisten wat het was, is op grote is met bijna 20 vrachtwagens geweest in totaal. En ik heb er nog wel gauw een 70-80 kunst weggegeven. Ik had maar 8000 kunstwerken. Daar moet het bewezen worden dat de werken in bruikleen waren. Waren het heel archiefste. En als mensen iets gegeven hebben, dan weet ik dat ze het kwijt aan de doos gaan. Maar ik kan niet vals te opmaken hoe ze van mensen dat zit er niet in. En bij een aantal werken waarvan ik gewoon kan getuigen dat. Zijn van degene die ze claimen. Interessanter is dat natuurlijk de gemeente iets doet waarvan ze helemaal niet weten of het terecht is. Want ik heb helemaal geen schuld, zoals in het NRC Handelsblad en het Noord-Hollands-Dagblad staat. Er is helemaal geen sprake van een schuld. Ik wil een uitsluiting van de rechter dat bij voorraad uitvoerbaar iets te claimen is waar een hoger beroep nog steeds op loopt. Dus het kan nog steeds zo zijn dat de gemeente heel onrechtmatig dit allemaal aan het veilen is, omdat dit hoger beroep uitgewezen wordt. Dat ik
helemaal
geld
van hun
krijg, bijvoorbeeld.
Duidelijk. Dus dat is al omstreden. Een ander ding wat mij opviel aan het verhaal is van, Ja, het moet 3,5 ton opbrengen. Maar als je zoveel stukken hebt, dan is 3,5 ton eigenlijk toch... Ja, dan vind ik dat eigenlijk helemaal niet zoveel geld. En is er dan niet iemand die dat gewoon even voor die veiling uit op tafel legt en wegprobleem?
Ja, dat lijkt me een hele oplossing die ik ook graag aanga. Ik heb van de rechter... Kijk, je moet weten, het staat onrechtmatig. Het is onrechtmatig gevoerd aan de veiling uit. Dat had ik teruggemoeten, maar mijn advocaat weigerde dat uit te voeren. En de gemeente niet dan. Ja, hulde dus samen met het veiling uit. Mijn advocaat. For the benefit of others, because it's open. Anybody can think about how it could be better. So there's an incredible rate of development. There's an incredible rate of people bringing ideas to it. If it was the property of one company, my company or anybody else's company, it would have been a block. Anything which is centralized becomes a block. If you let the whole world tackle it in parallel, it goes incredibly fast.
Are you happy with the way it's developed?
Very.
The picture has changed quite a lot since then, and Sir Tim has more reservations about some of the things happening on the web, like the unprecedented spread of fake news, the targeting of vulnerable voters with misinformation, corporations selling our personal information for profit, and now we have the rise of AI, also made possible by the web. And who knows where that's going to take us. When Sir Tim came into our studio, we spoke about all of these things. We'll hear about his concerns and what he thinks we can all do to protect ourselves from the worst of the web. But he also talked very warmly about his childhood, his family, and encounters at the coffee bar at the research lab CERN, where his idea was born. So Tim Berners-Lee, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You made science fiction fact. So how come you're not a billionaire?
Well, it was really important that the web should be free for anybody to use. And that would mean it has to be free of charge. So I couldn't charge people 2 cents a click, as well as ask them. I want people to put everything on the web, but that was a big ask.
Right, and you had to persuade people that indeed this should not be for sale.
Yes, I worked for an organisation called CERN in Switzerland. And CERN could have, in principle, they could have decided that anything going on in the web should be taxable in some way, but with royalties at CERN. But we got from them a commitment eventually in 1993 that they wouldn't charge royalties.
Right, which is a remarkable gift that you have given to the world, actually. But interestingly enough as well, you haven't seemed to pursue fame any more than you pursued money. I just want to mention a couple of names. Both men who were born in the same year as you, 1955, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, who also transformed our digital lives. Do you wish that you were as famous as them?
No, I don't. Life must be really... being famous must be total pain.
And your family is very important to you?
Very.
You're married to Rosemary. You have 5 children in your
between
family,
us, yeah.
Between you.
Mm.
Do they treat you as a public figure? Do they see you as a public figure?
Not so, no. You know, we've always had rules from when Alice and Ben were in school. We always had a rule that school should never talk about me on the web. And so they're in primary school, you know, all the teachers knew. There was one time when the headmistress came into Alice's class with a Time magazine, said, hey, Alice, is your dad on the front of Time magazine? And she said, what? She said, is this your dad? Yeah, that's my dad. What does he do at work? He talks to people. Meanwhile, the teacher was saying, no, stop. Headmistress had forgotten. And the rule, and so we had a rule that just my family would not talk about in school.
Right.
And now they're all big and old and wise. They're well past being fazed by fame.
Yeah. So you don't like the limelight much?
No, not that much.
No. This will make you, I think, in the modern era, a very curious sort of person, somebody who is not gone after fame and money. And I would really like to understand where that's come from. And I suppose the obvious place to start with that is your parents. A pretty extraordinary pair, by all
yes.
accounts.
Mum and Dad. Yeah, Mum and Dad met building the very first computer in the UK. And so, of course, that was a huge thing. And they were part of a team at Ferranti. And so that group of people, they were thinking about what is a computer anyway? What does it mean to be a computer, to have a computer? They were wondering about, could a computer be intelligent? What would that mean?
So these were discussions in your childhood home about what a computer could do.
Well, Dad wrote the speeches for Basil de Ferranti. Basil de Ferranti was the head of the Ferranti, and his speeches had to come from somewhere, and Dad was one of the people who writing speeches for him. And so they had to spend a lot of time explaining to people what a computer was and talking about things like ones and zeros. It worked with ones and zeros. It worked with binaries. He had two things. He had the examples with halfpennies and farthings, which back then were binary coins that we had. And so, and he made a computer out of, made a little computer out of water jets, so that when two water jets went on at the same time, they would go into a particular pot and go on that through the system. So
he made this at home?
He made it at home, yeah.
Did you help him?
Yeah, well, I admire the result, certainly. He did that because then you could see that computing was just logic. It's just, if this comes on, this comes on, then this comes on.
I know your parents were, of course, very logical, very rational people, given what they did. Mm-hmm. There's a fantastic story about your mum, Mary Lee, who's a real pioneer. But she, I think, was quite a devoted churchgoer. But she believed that all churches should have a notice on the door saying, take everything within metaphorically.
Yep, that's right.
So very rational people, but...
Well, rational, but, yes, mum was quite devout, but also very scientific.
Mm-hmm. And very creative and very imaginative. And I think you're the first of four children. She paused her career when she had you. And what was her motherly style? What was her approach to you?
Mostly letting us get on with it. So watchful negligence, she called it.
Watchful negligence.
So we were within walking distance of Fisherman Park, so that was a wonderful playground. We made a go-kart out of an old pram, with old pram wheels at the back and pushchair wheels at the front, and then we'd push that around all over the park.
And in the home, making train sets?
I eventually got really into trains. Partly I went to Emmanuel School, which is right between train tracks in London. So that once, if you go to, anybody who goes to Emmanuel, you're forced to look at trains because they go by right by the school. And so that was, so eventually I enjoyed making train sets. And when we converted the loft into two rooms, my request was mine should be as long as possible. So my brother's room was about square, but mine was long and thin because that's what you need for a train set.
Right, okay. How would you describe yourself as a boy?
As a boy, I was introverted, shy. So I went to an all-boys school. So that growing up, I didn't never had a girlfriend. While I was in high school, I never really went to dances and things. So I guess the energy went into mathematics and physics, mm-hmm. and electronics, so right. Building things. That's things I did with my friend, was building electronics.
Right. What was the focus of the family home?
I suppose, Mum was the driving force, I suppose. So she, Dad would go to work, and he was very, very involved with us as growing up, but Mum was the driving force. Mum organised everything. Mum organised, she has organised that we went camping, for example. She'd enjoyed camping when she'd been when she'd gone to Australia early on in her career. And so I think she found that being in a tent on the ground, knowing that's all you've got, is very, she did that in Australia, and we did that then later as a family. So we'd all go camping together. We'd go and stay in a friend's orchards, or we'd go and stay at a sort of National Trust campsite or something. And then we'd So we all knew that all we needed was a tent. And I think that's a very strong, gives you a strong feeling of self-sufficiency for the rest of life.
That's interesting. So I wonder if that ties into what we touched on earlier, which is that you're not that interested in money and things. Do you think that comes from your parents?
Well, I was also remember the tradition. When I invented the web, the internet had already been invented 20 years beforehand. So I was building on the shoulders of these giants who made the internet, so Vint Cerf and colleagues. And I was building on that, and all that was free. The internet was there to spread as an idea, but the really important thing was there should be only one web, and sort of keeping it free was important.
If the internet is the sort of infrastructure, if that's the way that computers talk to each other, how does the web then relate to the internet in the simplest terms?
So the web is everything. When you click on something, click on a link, that's the web. So when you type in something that starts HTTP, that's the web. None of that. Clicking on one thing and going to another thing somewhere in the world, that didn't exist before I invented it.
Right. Let's talk about how you invented this. So you went to university, you read physics, you go and get various jobs in the computer field, largely. You go to CERN. You mentioned CERN. This is this very well-respected, very international scientific research centre in Switzerland. And this is where you dream up this idea of the World Wide Web. What was the problem that you were trying to fix?
The problem I was trying to fix was that people from CERN come from all over the world. And when they come from all over the world, they bring with them different sorts of computer and different sorts of computer system and different sorts of documentation system. So all of those were incompatible systems. So if you wanted to find out about how did that module connect to another person's module, then in practice, what you needed to do, you'd find that person, you'd go and give them a coffee.
Right.
So the coffee space was really important. The coffee space was at the intersection of the different corridors. And so if you needed somebody else, you could wait till they walked by and pick them up. Mm-hmm. So in a way, shouldn't the web be something which could provide that functionality?
The world's coffee shop, basically.
The world's coffee shop.
Yeah. So I said that you dreamt up the World Wide Web, and I don't really know if that's what you did. When you see a problem, when you identify a problem and you're trying to think about a solution, do you code the solution primarily, or are you also having a vision? Is this also an act of imagination?
Both. When you code something up, supposing you're imagining an app, you imagine how the app would be, and you sit down with your computer, and you type, and you have in your mind's eye, you have what the app is going to look like, and that all turns into code. There's code for each box. And in fact, when I designed the web, in fact, I had a drag and drop system that I could design the app with. So basically, when you're just writing an app by yourself, then you have the requirements in your head and the design in your head, and then you code.
You're designing it, you're coding it, and you talk about designing apps, but this was the first app. This was entirely new.
This was the first web browser.
So how do you go about persuading other people to buy into what is in your head at that point, which is a vision that you have got? I imagine it's a little bit like trying to describe to somebody a colour that is not yet in existence. How do you do that?
It is a bit like that. It's called a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift is when the words for describing the new system don't exist in the old world. So now we talk about clicking. It's three clicks away, and people know what that means. But the idea that you would click and go to somewhere, anywhere in the world before was people just could not imagine it. And dealing with that lack of imagination was really hard. I'd find that I give a talk maybe to 100 people, and you'd notice three people would pick their ears up, for example, and come back and find me afterwards. And they'd get it, so a few people would. But I didn't need the whole world to be start using the web at once. I needed a few people.
And initially, you needed somebody to buy into the idea in the first place and to give you the freedom to work on it. And so I know you wrote to your boss, you've sent your plan, and you found out much later that the notes he'd written on it were vague but exciting, which is a fabulous description. But it took a while to get the go-ahead to say, go on, have a go, yes, see what you can come up with.
Well, Mike Sandel, in fact, the person I gave the memo to, he was diagnosed with cancer at that point. So he had much bigger things going on in his life. But he did tell me to just go ahead. He said, buy an X machine, because you've always wanted to buy one of those X boxes, which was made by Steve Jobs when he left Apple. And the next computer had really powerful tools for developing apps. So buy the next computer and use it to make some app. And so why don't you do that World Wide Web thing you've been talking about?
That was a lucky break, I think, for the world. So you then turn this around in a matter of months, get it ready for launch? I mean, unbelievably fast.
Well, 3 months it took. It has to get ready for Christmas because we had a baby. Our first baby was due. 24th, in fact. And anyway, CERN closed to save energy. CERN closed in the middle. So I started working on September. I had to get the app basically released by the end of the year.
This is while your wife is 8-9 months pregnant.
Yep.
You're working on this.
Yeah. And then Alice was born on the 1st of January, in fact. She was late. But that year was all about Alice. It wasn't about the web.
Oh, how interesting. Because you'd launched these two sort of babies into the world at once. But the real baby took priority.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. When you published the first web page, description, I think, of what the web was, which is still available actually to see online. What did that moment feel like? Did you think something big is about to happen?
There was never that sort of this is the moment when this is everything happening, because it started off as being almost empty web page, and then I filled it in a bit. And then steadily, the number of people who were looking at that web page went up by a factor of, in fact, doubled every 4 months. So, in fact, so that doubled every 4 months for the
self. As a boy?
As a boy, I was introverted, shy. So I went to an all boys school. So that growing up, I didn't, never had a girlfriend while I was in high school. I never really went to dances and things. So I guess the energy went into mathematics and physics and electronics,
right.
So building things. That's things I did with my friend, was building electronics.
Right. What was the focus of the family home?
I suppose, Mum was the driving force, I suppose. So she, Dad would go to work, and he was very, very involved with us as growing up, but Mum was the driving force. Mum organised everything. Mum organised that we went camping, for example. She'd enjoyed camping when she'd been when she'd gone to Australia early on in her career. And so I think she found that being in a tent on the ground, knowing that's all you've got, is very, you know, she did that in Australia, and we did that then later as a family. So we'd all go camping together. We'd go and stay in a friend's orchard, or we'd go and stay at a sort of National Trust campsite or something. And then we'd...
Fortunes off the back of it. But what about the man who dreamt it all up? No millions for him. He simply wanted to give it away for the benefit of others.
Because it's open, anybody can think about how it could be better. So there's an incredible rate of development, there's a credible rate of people bringing ideas to it. If it was the property of one company, my company or anybody else's company, it would have been a block. Anything which is centralised becomes a block. If you let the whole world tackle it in parallel, it goes incredibly fast.
Are you happy with the way it's developed?
Very.
The picture has changed quite a lot since then, and Sir Tim has more reservations about some of the things happening on the web, like the unprecedented spread of fake news, the targeting of vulnerable voters with misinformation, corporations selling our personal information for profit, and now we have the rise of AI, also made possible by the web, and who knows where that's going to take us. When Sir Tim came into our studio, we spoke about all of these things. We'll hear about his concerns and what he thinks we can all do to protect ourselves from the worst of the web. But he also talked very warmly about his childhood, his family, and encounters at the coffee bar at the research lab CERN, where his idea was born. So, Tim Berners-Lee, thank you very much indeed for joining us. You made science fiction fact. So how come you're not a billionaire?
Well, it was really important that the web should be free for anybody to use. And that would mean it has to be free of charge. So I couldn't charge people 2 cents a click, as well as ask them. I want people to put everything on the web, but that was a big ask.
Right, and you had to persuade people that indeed this should not be for sale.
Yes, I worked for an organisation called CERN in Switzerland. And CERN could have, in principle, they could have decided that anything going on in the web should be taxable in some way, but with royalties at CERN. But we got from them a commitment eventually in 1993 that they wouldn't charge royalties.
Right, which is a remarkable gift that you have given to the world, actually. But interestingly enough as well, you haven't seemed to pursue fame any more than you pursued money. I just want to mention a couple of names, both men who were born in the same year as you, 1955, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, who also transformed our digital lives. Do you wish that you were as famous as them?
No, I don't. Life must be really, being famous must be a total pain.
And your family is very important to you?
Very.
You're married to Rosemary. You have five children in your family, between you. Do they treat you as a public figure? Do they see you as a public figure?
Not so, no. You know, we've always had rules from when Alice and Ben were in school. We always had a rule that school should never talk about me on the web. And so they're in primary school, you know, all the teachers knew. There was one time when the headmistress came into Alice's class with a Time magazine, said, "Hey, Alice, is your dad on the front of Time magazine?" And she said, "What?" She said, "Is this your dad?" "Yeah, that's my dad." "What does he do at work?" "He talks to people." Meanwhile, the teacher was saying, "No, stop." Headmistress had forgotten. And the rule, and so we had a rule that just my family would not talk about in school. Right. And now they're all big and old and wise. They're well past being fazed by fame.
Yeah. So you don't like the limelight much?
No, not that much.
No. This will make you, I think, in the modern era, a very curious sort of person, somebody who is not gone after fame and money. And I would really like to understand where that's come from. And I suppose the obvious place to start with that is your parents. A pretty extraordinary pair, by all accounts.
Mum and Dad. Yeah, Mum and Dad met building the very first computer in the UK. And so, of course, that was a huge thing. And they were part of a team at Ferranti. And so that group of people, they were thinking about what is a computer anyway. What does it mean to be a computer, to have a computer? They were wondering about, could a computer be intelligent? What would that mean?
So these were discussions in your childhood home about what a computer could do.
Well, Dad wrote the speeches for Basil de Ferranti. Basil de Ferranti was head of the Ferranti. And his speeches had to come from somewhere, and Dad was one of the people who writing speeches for him. And so they had to spend a lot of time explaining to people what a computer was and talking about things like ones and zeros. It worked with ones and zeros. It worked with binaries. He had do things. He had the examples with halfpennies and farthings, which back then were binary coins that we had. And so, and he made a little computer out of water jets, so that when two water jets went on at the same time, they would go into a particular pot and go on that through the system. So
he made this at home?
He made it at home, yeah.
Did you help him?
Yeah, well, I admire the result, certainly. he did that because then you could see that computing was just logic. It's just, if this comes on, then this comes on.
I know your parents were, of course, very logical, very rational people, given what they did. There's a fantastic story about your mum, Mary Lee, who's a real pioneer. But she, I think, was quite a devoted churchgoer, but she believed that all churches should have a notice on the door saying, take everything within metaphorically.
Yep, that's right.
So very rational people, but...
Very rational, but yes, mum was quite devout, but also very scientific.
Mm-hmm. And very creative and very imaginative. And I think you're the first of four children. She paused her career when she had you. And what was her motherly style? What was her approach to you?
Mostly letting us get on with it. So watchful negligence, she called it.
Watchful negligence.
So we were within walking distance of Fisherman Park, so that was a wonderful playground. We made a go-kart out of an old pram with old pram wheels at the back and pushchair wheels at the front, and then we'd push that around all over the park.
And in the home, making train sets?
I eventually got really into trains. Partly I went to Emmanuel School, which is right between train tracks in London, so that once, if you go to, anybody who goes to Emmanuel, you're forced to look at trains because they go by right by the school. And so that was... So eventually I enjoyed making train sets. And when we converted the loft into two rooms, my request was mine should be as long as possible. So my brother's room was about square, but mine was long and thin because that's what you need for a train set.
Right, okay. How would you describe yourself as a boy?
As a boy, I was introverted, shy. So I went to an all-boys school, so that growing up I never had a girlfriend. While I was in high school, I never really went to dances and things, so I guess the energy went into mathematics and physics and electronics, so
right.
Building things. That's things I did with my friend, was building electronics.
Right. What was the focus of the family home?
I suppose... Well, mum was the driving force, I suppose. So she, dad would go to work, and he was very, very involved with us as growing up. But mum was the driving force. Mum organised everything. Mum organised that we went camping, for example. She'd enjoyed camping when she'd been when she'd gone to Australia early on in her career. And so she found that being in a tent on the ground, knowing that's all you've got, is very... she did that in Australia, and we did that then later as a family. So we'd all go camping together. We'd go and stay in a friend's orchard, or we'd go and stay at a sort of National Trust campsite or something. And then we'd... so we all knew... that all we needed was a tent. And I think that's a very strong, gives you a strong feeling of self-sufficiency for the rest of life.
That's interesting. So I wonder if that ties into what we touched on earlier, which is that you're not that interested in money and things. Do you think that comes from your parents?
Well, it was also, I remember, the tradition. When I invented the web, the internet had already been invented 20 years beforehand. So I was building on the shoulders of these giants who made the internet, so Vint Cerf and colleagues. And I was building on that, and all that was free. The internet was there to spread as an idea, but the really important thing was there should be only one web, and sort of keeping it free was important.
If the internet is the sort of infrastructure, if that's the the way that computers talk to each other. How does the web then relate to the internet in the simplest terms?
So the web is everything. When you click on something, click on a link, that's the web. So when you type in something that starts HTTP, that's the web. None of that. Clicking on one thing and going to another thing somewhere in the world, that didn't exist before I invented it.
Right. Let's talk about how you invented this. So you went to university, you read physics, you go and get various jobs in the computer field, largely. You go to CERN, you mentioned CERN. This is this very well-respected, very international scientific research centre in Switzerland. And this is where you dream up this idea of the World Wide Web. What was the problem that you were trying to fix?
The problem I was trying to fix was that people from CERN come from all over the world. And when they come from all over the world, they bring with them different sorts of computer and different sorts of computer system and different sorts of documentation system. So all of those were incompatible systems. And so if you wanted to find out about how did that module connect to another person's module, then in practice what you needed to do, you'd find that person, you go and give them a coffee.
Right.
So the coffee space was really important. The coffee space was at the intersection of the different corridors. And so if you needed somebody else, you could wait till they walked by and pick them up. Mm-hmm. So in a way, shouldn't the web be something which could provide that functionality?
The world's coffee shop, basically.
The world's coffee shop, yeah. So
I said that you dreamt up the World Wide Web. And I don't really know if that's what you did. When you see a problem, when you identify a problem and you're trying to think about a solution, do you code the solution primarily? Or are you also having a vision? Is this also an act of imagination?
Both. When you code something up, supposing you're imagining an app, you imagine how the app would be. And you sit down with your computer and you type. And you have, in your mind's eye, you have what the app is going to look like. And that all turns into code. There's code for each box. And in fact, when I designed the web, in fact, I had a drag-and-drop system that I could design the app with. So basically, when you're just writing an app by yourself, then you have the requirements in your head and the design in your head and then you code.
You're designing it, you're coding it, and you talk about designing apps, but this was the first app. This was entirely new.
This was the first web browser.
So how do you go about persuading other people to buy into what is in your head at that point, which is a vision that you have got? I imagine it's a little bit like trying to describe to somebody a colour that is not yet in existence. How do you do that?
It is a bit like that. It's called a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift is when the words for describing the new system don't exist in the old world. So now we talk about clicking, how it's three clicks away, and people know what that means. But the idea that you would click and go to somewhere, anywhere in the world before, was people just could not imagine it. And dealing with that lack of imagination was really hard. I'd find that I'd give a talk, maybe to 100 people, and you'd notice three people would prick their ears up, for example, and come back and find me afterwards. And they'd get it, so a few people would. But I didn't need the whole world to start using the web once. I needed a few people.
And initially, you needed somebody to buy into the idea in the first place and to give you the freedom to work on it. And so I know you wrote to your boss, you sent your plan, and you found out much later that the notes he'd written on it were vague but exciting, which is a fabulous description. But it took a while to get the go-ahead to say, go on, have a go,
yes,
see what you can come up with.
Well, Mike Sandel, in fact, the person I gave the memo to, he was diagnosed with cancer at that point. So he had much bigger things going on in his life. But he did tell me to just go ahead. He said, buy a next machine, because you've always wanted to buy one of those next boxes, which was made by Steve Jobs when he left Apple. And the next computer had really powerful tools for developing apps. So buy the next computer and use it to make some app. And so why don't you do that World Wide Web thing you've been talking about?
That was a lucky break, I think, for the world. Mm. So you then turn this around in a matter of months, get it ready for launch? I mean, unbelievably fast.
Well, 3 months it took. I had to get it ready for Christmas because we had a baby. Our first baby was due on December 24th, in fact. And anyway, CERN closed to save energy. CERN closed in the middle of December. So I started working on September. I had to get the app basically released by the end of the year.
So this is while your wife is 8-9 months pregnant.
Yep.
You're working on this.
Yep. And then Alice was born then on the 1st of January, in fact. She was late. But that year was all about Alice. It wasn't about the web.
Oh, how interesting, because you'd launched these two sort of babies into the world at once, but the real baby took priority.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. When you published the first web page, a description, I think, of what the web was, which is still available, actually, to see online, what did that moment feel like? Did you think something big is about to happen?
There was never that sort of, this is the moment, when is this everything happening? Because it started off as being almost empty web page, and then I filled it in a bit. And then steadily, the number of people who were looking at that web page went up by a factor of, in fact, it doubled every 4 months. So, in fact, so that doubled every 4 months for the first 3 years. So, the number of people using that first web server, the number of hits we had per day, went up at absolute rock solid exponential.
Did you see what this could become? Did you think this is going to change the way we live?
Well, I wanted everything on the web. And I designed it to be universal. So that was, there were lots of systems I'd seen designed which weren't universal, which had some constraint about the document you made. You had to put it on a particular sort of computer or something. But the web had to be unconstrained, it had to be universal.
When you say you wanted everything on the web, you mean everything on the web?
I meant anything originally, but now we've got more or less everything.
Right, okay. You were telling us about your parents, their values, their attitudes. When you were thinking about the web and bringing those values with you, were you thinking just about the good stuff that could happen there, the shared creativity, the exchange of ideas, you know, the easing of problems, the shared finding of solutions? Is that what you were thinking about?
Well, initially, I took the three previous people who'd made a consortium, so there would be just one system. And their motto was that technology was neutral. So, you know, they said, good people can use it, bad people can use it, but the technology itself is fundamentally, they thought, neutral. And I went along with that for a bit. So when people say, but what about the bad things? Well, they're, you know, fraud is illegal on the web or off the web, so the web didn't change that. So until I guess 2016, really, I felt that technology was neutral.
And then 2016.
And then 2016, the Trump elections and the Brexit election, and then people said maybe the web had been used to manipulate people to vote for something that was not in their best interests. And maybe the web technology itself was polarizing. So in other words, maybe, whereas the web itself might be neutral, maybe Snapchat isn't, maybe TikTok isn't, maybe Instagram isn't.
How did that make you feel?
Big double take. It made me very concerned that we should perhaps limit the extent to which people make their websites addictive, for example.
Okay.
Technology isn't always neutral. There's a social side when you design a technology. When you design something like Snapchat or something which is addictive, then you deliberately make it addictive. When you design something like Pinterest, I haven't heard of people getting addicted to Pinterest, but in both cases, people use Instagram or they use Pinterest. One of them is designed to be addictive, the other one isn't. People spend a lot more time on Instagram because they get stuck on it. But they can use Pinterest to share photos as well.
So what makes something addictive?
It's very deliberately the way you connect the AI algorithm to the system. You train the AI, then you choose what it is you give rewards to. You choose whether you reward it for keeping somebody on the platform, even though that might be making them angry, for example.
Because that increases engagement.
Yeah. So it's the way that the algorithm has been trained. If it's made to be trained to polarize people, then that's not a neutral piece of technology. That's a piece of technology which is making the world a worse place.
After the break, the inventor of the World Wide Web, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, on how we can all make the web safer for ourselves. We'll also put a question to him asked by an AI, which wants to know how he feels about having made its existence possible. This is Outlook, online at bbcworldservice.com/outlook and reachable on WhatsApp. Our number, +44 330 678 2707.
This is the BBC World Service, where our new series, Cyberhack, Evil Core,